What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics and how does it affect us? Polytalk is back to unpack the big questions like, why is it hard to get medicine you need in the Pacific?
It came to a point where he was admitted where he got blood poisoning. He needed antibiotics for that, and that was not available.
Join me, Scott Whitehair, on Polytalk.
Search up Polytalk in your favorite podcast app to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
This is Stories from the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia.
Hello and welcome to Stories from the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Bobby McCumber. When Rhea Moss Christian returned to her homeland of the Marshall Islands in her 20s, she arrived with questions on language, belonging and identity, and finding her place in a community that, although was a part of her birthright, she did not feel she did or could belong to. Growing up in California of the United States of America, Rhea often felt caught between worlds and an outsider in her own homeland. When we reflect with Rhea on her life and her career to this date, it is this journey of navigating her identity that led her to the stage of global diplomacy, where she stands as the first Pacific Islander woman to lead the world's largest tuna fisheries body, making decisions that affect billions of meals and millions of livelihoods and people across the globe. Rhea's story is one of finding strength and comfort in the in-between places and turning it into leadership for the Pacific. Rhea Moss Christian, welcome to Stories from the Pacific.
Hello, Bobby. Nice to be here.
Rhea, can you tell me about this decision you made to move back to the Marshall Islands in your early 20s? What brought you to that place?
I would say that there was actually a moment that I can remember quite vividly when I was interning in my final year of university at the Marshall Islands Mission to the United Nations. And I remember sitting there in that big General Assembly hall and seeing all of these nameplates of different countries. And I started making the list of all of the Pacific Island countries. And I thought to myself, one day I want to visit all of these places, but I want to go as part of work. So I wanted to have a purpose that would take me there in this international relations kind of space. And so when I returned to university for my last 6 months, I really just set myself toward getting back to the Marshall Islands so that I could continue to work in this world. I wanted to continue to work for the Marshall Islands, but find a way for that to happen in the Marshall Islands. I had also had an interest to go back to New York, but really knew that wasn't really going to work for me unless I went back to the islands to really learn and understand the culture and the customs and the way the government works.
Mm. Do you remember those first few days? What was going through your mind?
Yeah, it was exciting. I was so excited. I had just graduated from university and taken the trip in the summer with my mom and my sister. And I just felt like a sponge. I think a lot of times, a lot of graduates come out of university with the weight of the world on their shoulders. And I don't think I was any different. And I just had this belief that I could make a difference. Yeah, I think that's been tempered over the years and jaded in some ways. But at that time, at 21, I very much felt that I was so excited to just jump in and get started. So the first few weeks of our time there was vacation and visiting family in the outer islands. But I was so anxious to get to work and to start learning.
And how was it from being on holiday, vacation, to working? What was the dynamic shift there?
Well, my sister wasn't very happy with me that I wasn't going to be returning with her back to the U.S. But at that time, the Marshall Islands was hosting the Pacific Islands Forum that year, and I was part of the task force to organize it. And it was just, I just remember, it was just constant excitement. I was just, every day, I was just so excited to go to the office and make, you know, arrangements for people to come to Majuro for this Pacific Islands Forum. I just couldn't believe that I was doing exactly what I said I wanted to do about 8 months prior when I was sitting in New York. It was just amazing to me that I could now be in that space and doing all those things I wanted. I just remember every day was amazing and great, and I wanted more of it. And I was just looking for ways to get involved more and more into this government world. I was very much focused on public service and working for the government and finding a way to be part of foreign policy and international relations. I mean, really just looking back, incredible naivete at age 21 in how things work, but really excited. Yeah.
How did your colleagues react to your excitement to coming into work every day?
I don't know. I mean, I did bond with cousins that I'd come to learn were my relatives who were also working in that space. And I remember there were a group of us. They were all in the same age group and had just finished up college and come back. And we were all sort of in this place of looking for how we could contribute. So I don't remember feeling alone in any way. I remember feeling part of a group of new graduates, new Marshallese, who were looking for where we could fit. And there was a generation gap between us and those who had been there, who were really the ones who established the systems. And we could feel that generational conflict. We could feel that tension. But these were our elders, and then, you know, and right now relatives, and some, you know, many were uncles. And so I felt like I belonged to this group of kind of a new wave of thinking and how we were going to fit into this next phase of the Marshallese experience. I mean, at that point, that was 1996, and the country was only 10 years old. 1986 was when we signed our compact of free association with the United States. So we didn't have a lot of experience as an independent country. So it was an exciting time.
What were some of the challenges you were putting forward to those elders?
I was really keen on doing a lot of research. And it's funny when I think back to how we were connecting to the internet with the dial-up. And, you know, I can still hear the dial-up tone in the back of my mind. And laptops were kind of a new thing. But I remember really wanting to go through a process, a really structured process of developing foreign policy. I mean, again, just the naivete when I think back to that time, but wanting to be part of a group of, you know, like a group think, a brainstorm. Here's what we think would be important or a good path for us to go down. And so there was this desire to really put our new degrees to work, our new, you know, our university degrees to work and try to develop a system and a process. But looking back, this was not we weren't coming at it in some ways. And as Marshallese, we were coming with our Western educations. And, you know, I learned after a couple of years that I needed to reverse my thinking. And instead of coming in with this idea that I was going to bring these new ideas and land them on everybody's, you know, desks, and this is how we were going to do it, I really needed to step back and learn first. What is everybody currently doing? Is there a way? Is there a space for my way of thinking and my mentality to work in a complementary way with what is currently the system? And I think that was tough. That was tough to kind of have that sense of excitement and belief kind of turned on its head and to realize, no, if you want to be here and make an impact, you need to sit back and listen for a while. So that, I think, has really informed the rest of my career. And I really try to be aware of how my ideas are informed, what lens I look through when I come to this work.
Just to explore that learning a little bit further, what did those lessons make you reflect on when considering your own way of thinking and belonging in this community that you came to join?
Well, it really made me appreciate everyone who came before me in a different way. I don't think I was dismissive necessarily, but I just don't think I appreciated enough how things had been done up to that point when I came into the picture, because I just had so much enthusiasm and so much excitement and so many things I'd learned that I wanted to apply and, you know, figure out how to apply. And I think that's just my tendency to sometimes get ahead of myself and to not sit back and listen. And so it really taught me to remember that there were so many, the country was formed on by some really incredible thinkers and innovators and visionaries about what Marshall Islands independence would look like and should look like, and how a government should function in a culture like the Marshalls, which has a traditional chief system, which is matrilineal. You know, all these things that I had yet to understand because I didn't grow up there. And so it was humbling. It was a reminder to me to remember that I was privileged to have the opportunity, but that opportunity could be taken from me as easily as it was given to me, and that I really needed to make sure that I was taking the time that was necessary to understand it before I could contribute to it, because otherwise my contributions would probably not work because I didn't understand what I was contributing to.
After the forum, what came next for you?
I was given a role in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and my portfolio was Asia Pacific. And I was the Foreign Service, I can't remember the title, but I was a junior officer for that portfolio. And because I had done a thesis in my final year at college on fisheries, I still had an interest in fisheries. I didn't think that I was going to continue with that necessarily when I went to the islands, but I wasn't closed off to the idea. But I was sent to a fisheries meeting, and at that time, very few government officials from the Marshall Islands were covering fisheries. So it was sort of a wide open playing field. That's very different from now, where Marshallese delegations are quite big, and there are a lot of members representing different interests who are now engaged. But at that time in the mid-90s, there were very few people. And so it just sort of evolved from this first fisheries meeting. And the more I learned, the more I wanted to learn. And there were, like I said, it was just a wide open space. There was so much opportunity for me to get involved in this work. And so I didn't even have to go looking for it. It was sort of right in front of me if I wanted it, and I could take it. And it just kind of took off from there. And then we organized the first negotiating conference, or it was the second negotiating conference for what is now WCPFC. And I was involved in that organizing because I had just had the experience of the forum the year before. And so it was just like every step I was taking was getting me more embedded into this work. And it was really up to me whether I wanted to stay there. And I did. And so we organized that negotiating conference in 97. And I just continued on from there.
You're listening to Stories from the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Bobby McCumber, and I'm speaking with Rhea Moss-Christian. So, look, today you are the Executive Director and former Chair of the Western and Central Pacific Fisheries Commission, but you were also the first Pacific Islander woman to take up this role. Now, I'd like to ask you about your journey to that role, but first, could you just explain to our listeners who may not be familiar with what fisheries management is? Can you explain that?
Yes. So in the world of tuna fisheries, tuna as a commercial species is one of the top five traded seafood commodities. It's a massive, I think it was estimated at $34 billion in 2023 or 2024. So it's a massive industry globally. And the Pacific, the Western and Central Pacific, manages the world's largest tuna fishery. So around 55% of the world's tuna comes from this part of the world. So tuna politics is incredibly important for so many reasons: food security, economic security. It represents for a lot of Pacific Island countries high revenues, annual revenues every year that supports all kinds of economic development initiatives in these islands, and as well as education and health. So the world of fisheries management, in tuna fisheries in particular, is dynamic. It's highly relevant to oceans health, global oceans health generally, and just to economic development throughout the world.
When you first came back home to the Marshall Islands, did you ever think you would be in a role like this?
Oh, never. Never did I think I would live in Phone Bay, that I would be in this role that I am. I don't think I looked that far ahead. I knew that I wanted to stay in the field, but I stepped out of it for a time as well. I had periods over the last 30 years where I wasn't working at all on anything Pacific Island related or fisheries related. And I always came back because I learned maybe from leaving it that this is where I belong and where I feel the most comfortable and passionate. But never, if you'd asked me 20 years ago, do you see yourself living in Phone Bay and working here? No, not even. It was not even on my radar.
You mentioned earlier that you moved with your mum back to the Marshall Islands. Can you tell us a bit about your mum?
Yeah, so she didn't stay. So she lived, let's see, mom's story. she left the Marshall Islands after I was born in 1974. And I'm the youngest of three. And my dad was an American Peace Corps volunteer. And so we all relocated back to the U.S. with where my dad was from in California. And she began the process of, you know, assimilating to life in America. She wasn't the only Marshallese who had migrated over to the U.S. with an American Peace Corps volunteer. It's kind of funny how there's sort of a little cohort of us, what I call havesies, of Peace Corps babies. And she, you know, just growing up with her and learning about the Marshall Islands through her, was my only connection. I think we visited once when I was little, but these were times when travel was not easy and it was expensive. And my mom always stayed connected, but she wasn't able to visit as often as she wanted. And I think what I've really come to appreciate since she passed away, it has been almost 13 years now, is how hard she worked in her life to just be prosperous in her life, you know, to have a life that she loved. And she created that for herself. She was born on one of the outer islands called Jaluit in 1944, right at the end of the war. And her father took her up to the northern island of Ailuk, where she was raised by her father and her aunt. He taught her the value of hard work and education, and she was sent to Fiji after high school, where she was enrolled in a home economics and nursing program, gaining skills to add to her life skills. And I think life in the U.S. for her obviously was a big transition. But my mom was someone who could really connect with a lot of people in different ways. And she had this incredible talent. She was a seamstress. And she put herself through school. And we ended up graduating on the same weekend from college. And she graduated from Southern Oregon University in theater arts. She had a love of Shakespeare, which is still, to me, sometimes baffling. Here's this Marshallese lady who had a love of Shakespeare, who's so difficult to understand. And she ended up working at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival in the costume department until until she got sick and passed away. That's where she was. And she loved it. She absolutely loved it. She loved making these incredible costumes for Shakespeare plays and interacting with actors and just being creative and using her creativity with this incredible skill set to contribute to this beautiful art of theater. And yeah, it's a great legacy. I'm really privileged that, is to be part of her story.
You speak very fondly of your mother. How has your mum's life and experiences shaped you today?
Well, I think that hard work and just pushing through the discomfort is partly through watching her in her assimilation into American culture and teaching me not to sweat the small stuff, which I'm not good at. I sweat the small stuff all the time, but I can hear her voice in the back of my head many times saying not to overthink. I think that's very difficult for me, is to not overthink. But she just, I think I inherited her calmness in under pressure. And I think that was a real asset for me when I was chairing big meetings of the commission, that pressure was definitely there. That stress and that anxiety was there, but I knew how not to show it. And so I could get through situations because I think I learned from her, and she did face adversity. You know, my parents divorced, and then she got cancer later in life, and I never saw her cry. I never saw her cry. And I'm not saying that that's necessarily a good thing. I don't have anything against crying. But what I took from that is just the incredible amount of strength that she carried to have to go through so many big changes in her life. And I think it made me less afraid to move myself. I've lived in many different locations in life, and I realized that I've lived here in Pohnpei probably longer than I've lived anywhere in my whole life. But I've had so many addresses, and I think that it's that strength that I carried through her of being able to take on new things and to know that I was going to be okay and to not crumble under pressure and to just not sweat the small stuff.
What would you say has been one of the most frightening new things that you've taken on?
You know, in this role, I would say that there's always a fear of making a mistake that you can't recover from, because the responsibility is so big. And even though I know inherently that I am up to this role and that I can handle this responsibility, there's still a fear that you'll make a decision or something will happen that's just so unexpected or just so complex that I won't be able to manage it. But I think those are just stories that I tell myself, because it's probably the lingering self-doubt that's always there. Because in reality, in the end, there really isn't much that's going to happen here that's going to be unsolvable or unexpected. And also, I don't do this work alone. There's so many people that are part of this organization that are contributing to its work that I think it's unreasonable to expect that I would do anything alone or, you know, without having consultation or without it being informed or advised by others. And so I think when I remember those realities, that fear subsides. But I do think I maintain a healthy level of fear. I think it's necessary in some ways to sort of keep me on my toes. And I don't know, maybe indirectly, it's a way to sort of keep things interesting and exciting.
Not to bring a downer to the conversation, but I'm curious as to what keeps you up at night when you think about the Pacific and the future of the Pacific in your community.
Yeah, I worry about the ability for the region to stay together in the face of a lot of external challenges that are taking place. We're reading a lot about security tensions in this region and this play between China and the US. And this dominates a lot of Asia-Pacific news. And it's easy to get wrapped up in this narrative that we're just a region, almost like a chessboard, you know, and it's two world powers jockeying for control. And we have this role to play, and sometimes we don't, but we're just here. And what I try not to get wrapped up in that, because I think it can take us down a dangerous path of forgetting about our roots in the islands and how people have been on these islands for centuries and living in harmony, in concert with the environment, and have been resilient to changes over centuries of time. And that doesn't go away. That gets passed down. It's inherent in island people. And so I worry that all of this geopolitical and security tension and all this jockeying for power in the region will make us forget those roots and forget the strength that island people have. You know, I watched the Forum, Pacific Island Forum Leaders Summit just wrapped up, and I followed the news on that and I read their communique. I don't think anything was surprising there, but these are just words right now, and we need to see action. There are so many, as I said, external pressures, not just from countries, but just issues that stand to divide the region. And it doesn't mean that each country doesn't have its own independent national interest and pursues its own national interest, but collectively there's so much more that the region has in common and can work together on. And so in a lot of ways, I'll reference the Fiji Prime Minister's Ocean of Peace Declaration. I think that that's a really interesting initiative and has a lot of potential, and it remains to be seen how that manifests itself into regional cooperation and togetherness.
I'm going to take a bit of a different turn here now, Rhea. You have a funny story about meeting and proposing to your husband. I would love you to share that with our listeners, if you wouldn't mind.
Okay, I did warn him that this might come up. So I think it was my third time living in Honolulu, moving back to Honolulu. And it was 2008, and I was back with the U.S. National Marine Fisheries Service, and there was a meeting coming up in Pohnpei of the WCPFC, and I was asked to join the delegation. And I was supposed to come for a few days and then leave halfway through and go to Australia for another meeting. And about a week before, my boss told me to just go ahead and cancel Australia and just stay for the duration in Pohnpei. And just prior to this meeting, I was talking to a cousin who had just come here, and she was mentioning this guy, Chris. And I had remembered meeting him 10 years prior, but didn't really know him. And so we came to this meeting, and I didn't realize that I was staying at his family's hotel. And I saw him and said hello and said, "Oh yeah, okay, I remember you." And, you know, days went by. I was in and out going to meetings. And one evening I came back and he was sitting in the lobby, and I joined him and his friend. And we got to talking, and you know, it was just a really comfortable re-meet. It's probably the first time I'd really spoken to him, and it was just really felt really comfortable. And so after we spent the next couple of days meeting up again, and then after maybe 3 days, 4 days or so, I decided, I think I'll just stay in Pohnpei for another week. I'll just tell my boss that I'm going to have a little vacation by myself. And he said, "Okay, that's fine. Go ahead. You have leave. You can stay." So I did. And I don't think I told anyone in my family or my friends. I just stayed for, so I extended for another week and we spent more time together. And I think about halfway through that second week, I said to Chris, I think we should get married. And I don't know. I don't know. I don't remember really thinking it through. I just remember thinking, I'm just going to throw this out there and see what happens. And, you know, what a great surprise that he said, okay. And so then it was like, okay. So this is what we're going to do then. So if that's the case, I'm going to go back to Honolulu for a year and then I'll come back. And that's what we did.
Are you always this decisive in life?
I think so. I'm not impulsive. I won't say, even though that sounds really impulsive, and I guess in some ways it was, probably in my way, I probably had given it enough thought in my mind to say it. But I think also I'm not afraid to take chances. And so maybe that's what that was. It's just, I was prepared for him to say, I think that's a bad suggestion. And then I would just go on my way. But it has worked. And 15 years later, here we are.
How did people react when you told them the news?
Oh, they couldn't believe it. They thought, how can this be? You just moved back to Hawaii. How are you now engaged in moving over to a place we've never heard of?
Oh.
And I think my family was, yeah, very much in disbelief. But I think also they just kind of had come to accept that I might just move around in life and make these decisions that would surprise them. But ultimately, they trusted my judgment.
Well, congratulations on 15 years together. Can you tell us about your family today?
So we have one daughter. She's 11. And so we're quite small, I guess, maybe in the typical island family. My husband is one of two children. His family is, his extended family is huge in Pohnpei, as is mine. Both of our mothers have many, many siblings, some of whom are half siblings. So lots of family in Pohnpei for his side. His father is in government. His father is a former president for FSM and now a member of Congress. And so living in his world, in this family, has it requires a lot of patience, I will say, because there's a lot of expectation and a lot of visibility on a political family, and they own businesses. And so that was a big adjustment for me. I'm a very private person, believe it or not. And I like to be alone. I really love to be alone, actually. I don't like to be around lots of people. So it was a real adjustment to come into a family that was so big, with so much community and expectation and obligation, something that I hadn't had a lot of time to experience or learn about when I was in the Marshall Islands, partly because my mom wasn't living there when I was there. So there was a learning curve after we first got married, to just be comfortable in this kind of a communal setting, in this where there was a lot of expectation and a lot of coming together for different reasons.
As someone who has had a lot of addresses, do you think today you have found your place in your community?
I do. And I have thought about this, because community was something that was hard for me to find for much of my life, or actually maybe since I left high school, felt like I had that in childhood. I do feel like I have that now. I feel, let's see, comfortably rooted here in Pohnpei. This job that I'm in, I can only do a maximum of 8 years. I lived here before this job. I will live here after this job. My daughter is from here. I want her to know her roots. So, yeah, I have come to really love and appreciate life in Bombay and the way that people here and this island has embraced me and accepted me. There are times when I still feel a little out of place. I definitely feel that. That might be just in my head, but overall, this very much feels like home now.
Mm-hmm. When you think about your legacy, what do you hope it will be?
I hope that people will remember that I care deeply and that everything I tried to do came from a place of really just believing that the changes that I introduced or the things that I wanted to do were because I really believed that they were going to be meaningful, that they were going to make an important impact, and that they may not be drastic or happen overnight, but that everything I did just came from this place of just conviction and this passion for doing something that's lasting, that's meaningful, not just for the sake of it, but because it matters. And I think that's why I'm so drawn to public service, because I think this is one of the best ways to really work with a community, to really understand what a community needs and then provide and make a contribution to it. Now, it doesn't mean that you can't do that from a non-public space. There's plenty of private sector initiatives that are also impactful, but I just feel that I think about this sometimes because it's hard to explain to my daughter what I do. She knows I sit at a desk and I sit at computers, and it's hard to explain what fisheries management looks like and what that means. But we also try to communicate our work to the broader community. And so I think about, okay, so what does this mean to people? Why does it matter that I come to this office every day and sit at these computers and read papers about fisheries science and develop agendas for meetings that why does it all matter? And I just hope that I will be able to be remembered as someone who created meaning out of all of that, who created a space for all of that paperwork and all of those meetings, all those conversations to lead to good outcomes for many generations. And I'm just part of a big puzzle here. I'm just a small piece of that because there are so many factors that go into this work. I get to be in a position where I have a certain level of responsibility and opportunity, and I don't want to waste that. And so I'm trying to use that to make my contribution while I have this time and in this space just a little bit bigger, and because it will change over time. And so, yeah, I hope that my legacy is that I contributed to something that lasts because it works, because it's good.
Rhea Moss-Christian, thank you so much for joining me, for discussing all things family, politics, community, work, and love. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
That was Rhea Moss-Christian, Executive Director of the Western and Central Pacific Fisheries Commission. You've been listening to Stories from the Pacific. I'm Bobby McCumber. To hear more stories about unique and incredible people from the Pacific, just search for Stories from the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia. If you or someone you know has an interesting story to share, you can email us at storiesfromthepacific@abc.net.au. This story was produced on the lands of the Yuggera and Turrbal people. I'm hosting this story on the lands of the Kaurna people.